are listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming live at CITR.ca and via podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. So, welcome everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Sector. This is episode 47 here on the show. And we have a fantastic one today. Lots of content to get to. Really packed. So we'll see how things go. I know that on last week's show, I talked about diving into the Truth and Reconciliation Council, the decisions, a bit of the history in the residential schools. I do want to get to that, but we also have a fair bit of content to go through, and I do wanted to kind of touch base on all of it. So we'll take it by ear and see how things go and what sparks the most conversation. Speaking of conversation, we do of course love to hear your feedback here on The Sector. If you'd like to share any thoughts or comments with us, you can post them to Twitter. You can direct them at me, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow on Twitter. Of course, a comment on Facebook. You can also email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, and you can comment on our blog and website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Also, while there, you can find all of our show notes and podcast links. So it's very convenient, isn't it? Excellent. Well, speaking of feedback and getting involved in things, CITR is moving to a new station, and you can get involved in that as well. So as many of you know, I mentioned on last week's show, CITR is moving from the old Student Union building here on UBC to the brand new one, which is happening later this month. On Friday, June 26th, there will be a wake for the old CITR studio. That's happening at 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock p.m. on Friday. And then on Saturday, June 27th, the first and last broadcast. So the last broadcast from CITR's old digs and the first broadcast to the new one. The switchover will happen at around 2 p.m., so that should be really exciting. So during those 2 days, there'll be a lot of interesting programming here on CITR, a few preemptions, but there'll be some alumni broadcasts as well as basically special programming to commemorate the old sub and, celebrate the moving into of the new sub. So should be very exciting, and I hope you'll tune in and check those things out. You know, it's interesting. I took a little bit of a tour of the new Student Union building. Just kind of wandered around, and it's quite nice, very sleek, very modern. I was surprised because the name of the new Student Union building, as far as I understand it, is The Nest. And yes, that was my reaction as well. It's a weird name, The Nest. This is, of course, where, birds regurgitate food for their baby birds, which is not exactly the best image, I guess, for a campus student union building. And it's also a little bit, I don't know, it just doesn't fit. This is university. I think we have kind of flown the nest at this point. So I could have used a better name. I guess things like the hub are a bit overused, but well, maybe there'll be a new name convention at some point in the near future. Anyway, as I was saying, lots to discuss on today's show. Let's take a quick break here, though. We'll return after these messages, and we'll get on with all the great content here on The Sector. Stay tuned.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking...
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind, make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. For instance, I'm walking along, and I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes. And she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow, discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism, as always. Anyway, before the break, I mentioned our great packed show. And to get to the first big topic, I want to discuss Bill C-51 once again. Now, I've mentioned before on the show the ramifications of Bill C-51. Not only does it limit our freedoms, our civil rights here in Canada, it is an example, I think, of security theater in that this is designed to make us feel safe and yet ultimately will not, and ultimately has some very concerning, troubling aspects to this that will and potentially can very seriously damage the civil discourse going on in Canadian politics, as well as in just civil society. I mean, C-51 allows anybody who is deemed guilty of counterproductive discussion, debate, activities to have them arrested and charged as terrorist. I mean, these vague notions are so over the top draconian. It's like something out of like a bad essay on 1984. It really is. So obviously we've talked about this and the problems that this has for Canada going forward. Now, the Liberals, despite not having any direct impact on the bill whatsoever, voted for the law in the House of Commons, led by Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. And the bill, of course, passed, regardless of who voted for it, because the Conservatives have a majority. But a lot of people raised the concerning question that this shows that Trudeau is far more aligned with conservative values than he is with liberal ones. And a lot of people have said, you know, this means that the Liberal Party is not the Liberal Party anymore. They are a centrist party that has drifted so far to the right as to be unrecognizable. This is not Justin Trudeau's father's party anymore. And this, of course, has led to quite a surge in support for the NDP. So again, we'll have to see how that plays out in the next coming months for the election. More recently, however, the Bill C-51 passed the Senate. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, the Senate is supposed to be Canada's second sober body of intellectual debate, designed to review everything that the House passes, and ultimately they determine whether or not, you know, it becomes law or it becomes legislation, or whether or not it goes any further. The Senate could reject something, send it back down to the House. It could, well, I mean, that's pretty much what it does. Anyway, so there was some hope that the Senate would reject Bill C-51. It was one of the last, I think, ditch efforts by progressives in this country. There were a lot of petitions, a lot of, I think, heroic efforts to contact your senators, email senators, let them know that this is egregious, it's awful, and all that. I mean, like, I think we should applaud that effort. It was great to see that kind of political engagement. Unfortunately, I think it was likely doomed to begin with. The conservative senators voted for it. However, some liberal senators voted against it, which is a good thing. I mean, it's definitely heartening to see that there are at least a few liberal senators who haven't forgotten what the word liberal actually means. So that was nice. And there was also a couple interesting quotes. I wanted to read a few to you here, just to give you a bit of perspective, I think, on some of the political ramifications of all this. So to quote James Cowan, the Senate Liberals leader, and he was quoted in the Huffington Post Canada, He said that senators would vote en masse against the bill, which he dubbed over the top. Cowan said at the time that he had not discussed the bill with Trudeau, who supported the legislation in the House of Commons. Quote, he is entitled to his view, and I am entitled to my view, Cowan said. Quote, what I don't have to worry about is what effect it is going to have on my election chances, end quote. Which is a subtle dig, I think, at the fact that the Senate needs to be freaking reformed. Because senators don't have to be elected, they are appointed. They are completely undemocratic, anti-democratic, if you would want to use that term. And it is a little bit shocking and disturbing that such an important bill, such an important law in Canadian history, ultimately came down to a bunch of people who weren't elected by the population to finally okay it. And I mean, I guess if you want to take that analogy to its logical extremes, it's also going to go to somebody who was born into privilege to finally finalize that bill. I mean, it's not exactly going to go in front of Queen Elizabeth, but it's going to go in front of her representative of her rule here in Canada. And again, like, you know, it does raise a lot of extra questions about autonomy and democracy here in this country. But anyway, getting back to the question of the day here, 25 Liberal senators voted against Bill C-51. So that's nice. That is very, I think, heartening in some respect. But it is a hollow victory, of course, because the bill did pass. Trudeau has effectively dodged this question. And, you know, I mean, it's in some respects, you kind of expect him to at least present a unified argument or at least a sensible argument. But he's failed to do that at all. I mean, this is a man who has demonstrated a kind of profound disregard for what his voter base wants from him as leader of the Liberal Party. So now the other interesting thing about this is that Trudeau was recently here on UBC, where he was on a bit of a campus tour type thing. And not surprisingly, the UBC student body grilled him a little bit on Bill C-51. Now, the Liberal Party had posted the full 22-minute video, I believe, on their website. It was very, very quickly taken down once news agencies got a hold of it and started to see the fact that Trudeau was becoming really agitated and really anxious after this sort of prolonged debate from these students. I mean, that just kind of goes to show you what kind of leader he is. So they took it down. Fortunately, there's been a few links to sort of shortened versions. And there's a clip that I want to play here on the show. So we'll go to that right now. And again, this is Justin Trudeau talking about Bill C-51. It's partly from his student talk. And then there's a bit of media afterwards where he talks to reporters. So I'll just play this right now for you.
A majority of experts are against it. I don't think the majority of conservatives need liberal votes. Why not send a message to the conservative government that Canadians don't want infringements on their civil liberties?
I totally agree. I agree that Canadians have real concerns about this bill, and that's why we're putting forward some very, very clear improvements. My hope, however, is that this government, the same way it did on C-31, the Tell Vic Everything bill, and some other ones, that it actually realizes from public pressure that it is going to have to make significant amendments to this bill. But we know that tactically, this government would be perfectly happy if the opposition completely voted against this bill, because it fits into their fear narrative and lets people, you know, bash people on security. The fact is, I don't want to encourage them to not make those amendments. If they don't make the amendments, then the Liberal Party won't support this bill. They can make political hay out of it. And I do not want this government making political hay out of an issue, more than they're already trying to, out of an issue as important as security for Canadians. This conversation might be different if we weren't months from an election campaign, but we are. And the fact is, these measures three measures in particular I talked about, that are going to keep Canadians safer in the immediate, deserve to be brought in. The bill needs to be fixed, and if this government doesn't do it now, we will do it after the next election.
Okay, so you yourself have expressed serious concerns about this bill.
Yes.
And yet have already all but unconditionally guaranteed there's a support of the bill.
Yes, that's the same question we had earlier.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
You specifically said, I am hopeful that the government will respond to our serious and thoughtful
amendments
on OPEC, but if the government does not bring us in, I will still support the bill.
Yes.
Now, if the government does not accept your amendments,
yes, if the government does not support my amendments, we're still going to support the bill.
We will still support
the
bill.
Yes.
But we'll change it upon...
We will be offering the changes as part of our election platform because Canadians are asking for those changes. And when we form government, we'll bring it in. Yes.
Sir, I must say that supporting a bill you know is dangerous while promising to reform it when you've been elected into government is tantamount to holding our rights hostage.
Yes.
Our vote is our ransom.
No, I appreciate that. I've heard this. We've heard this from Canadians, and I share those concerns about this bill. And that's why the pressure that you and everyone else are putting on this government is getting them to understand that if they don't bring in oversight, if they don't bring in review, if they don't narrow the overly broad provisions in this bill, they're going to have a very difficult time in the next election campaign convincing Canadians that they're worthy of their trust. And I think that's a good thing. The Canadians are challenging them on this, and I certainly hope that it will result in this government making significant amendments to this bill. But the fact is there are elements in this bill that keep Canadians safe right now. And I'm not going to... Sorry?
Can you give an example?
Yes, I give three examples. If you listen, preventative arrests. Preventative arrests. Sorry. There's a whole bunch of people here with questions, okay? And I think I've been very generous, and I've answered a couple of times on this one. I appreciate your presence here today. It's great to see you. Thank you very much for your support. I'm glad you're taking an interest in the process, but I am going to get a few more questions in on this. Thank you very much.
My ideal situation is this government actually amending this legislation in the short term. And I'm not so worried about electoral positioning as you seem to be. I'm worried about trying to get this bill improved for Canadians right now. And actually, if you think about the Conservatives and the way they approach things, they would rather be able to paint the entire opposition as being soft on terror, as they like to do it. And I don't want to give them that incentive to reject our amendments and our proposals. I put them forward in a constructive measure that will improve this bill in a way that Canadians are asking for this bill to be improved, and I hope they're able to do it because there's no political win for them in not doing it. So I actually want to make a difference right now by removing it from the partisan realm. But I totally understand the concerns that so many people have expressed. I just know that in many cases they're expressed about the government making the changes as much as they are about the legislation itself.
Where would you make your amendments?
In committee. That's where it happens. Thank you very much for all your questions. Thanks for being here, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Justin Trudeau talking to students here at UBC, and that last little clip that you heard was him talking to news media here at UBC, including CITR. So excellent. Well done. Good work, everybody. Anyway, now I wanted to highlight, I mean, you heard what he had to say there, and I think that, you know, it is kind of a political tactic that he's gambling on here. I think it's a bad one. And I think that he's making... but what he's suggesting, of course, that the expanded powers in the Act are good, I think is clearly wrong. I think that if he looked at the evidence, it would indicate that they are, in fact, clearly wrong. They're not going to work. But I do wanted to highlight a couple of the questions. I mean, this the woman in the video that you heard, kind of hard to make out exactly what she was saying, so I just want to quote her directly from a news article in the Huffington Post, just because I think it's a really good question. It's a really good point. It says, "Sir, I must say that supporting the bill that you know is dangerous while promising to reform it when you've been elected to government is tantamount to putting our rights hostage, and our vote is our ransom." Now, This is really true. It's a very good point that this person raised. And I think that Trudeau has no response to that because it is absolutely true. He is trying to gamble and suggest that if you're unhappy with this bill, give my government the political mandate to fix it. And yet his government had an opportunity to stand up and say, no, no, we're not going to support this bill. But what they did was they did support the bill. They voted for it. And while that vote didn't have any direct response on or direct impact on whether or not it passed, he now expects us to believe that he has the political wherewithal to fix it. And whether or not the Conservative government was going to make hay with the notion that the political left was soft on terror, you know, maybe Trudeau should have trusted the fact that a majority of Canadians don't support this bill, likely won't support this bill, regardless of what Stephen Harper has to say about it. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a bit of a bad decision on his part. Shifting gears politically to talk about a different horrible bill that is changing the way Canadian law makes sense. We're talking now about Bill C-24. This bill, also designed to fight terrorism in Canada, and again, this country is just assailed by terrorism these days, apparently. Bill C-24 was designed to allow the government to revoke citizenship of dual citizens convicted of terrorism. But because of the way the bill is structured, it can also apply to Canadians born in Canada and who are eligible for dual citizenship. Now, basically what this means is that if you are a dual citizen, say you're from France and you have Canadian citizenship, and you get accused of terrorism, which you think, you know, when you're accused of terrorism, that's pretty bad. There's something going on funny there, you know, something not good is happening to you. But you could have your citizenship revoked. And what that means in practical terms is that, you know, you could be kicked out of the country, you could be, thrown in jail. But it also means you lose your rights as a Canadian. You could be, you know, deported to a prison somewhere and tortured. You could be deported back to your home country and tortured. You could be deported back to your home country and executed after being tortured. There is a lot of really bad fallout from such a bill. Not the least of which is if you're ever wrong about accusing somebody of terrorism, or if somebody is innocent in any degree, and you strip their citizenship and convict them to, you know, some horrible fate, you've just allowed an innocent person to suffer immensely. It's a very shocking and draconian bill. Again, it kind of follows an example here, as we can see. Recently, the BC Civil Liberties Association has been raising awareness on this with a petition which started last year but has gained additional 20,000 signatures this weekend alone in response to the bill. The problem that the BC CLA, as another activist, see with this is that the bill could be used to target non-terrorists quite easily. Many legal experts warn that the list of offenses could increase. So, for instance, removal of dual citizenship might not just be limited to terrorism in the future. It could be related to any other crime, or even non-crime. It could be related to things that a current government feels is not patriotic enough, or perhaps is even just suspect. The gray area that exists between, you know, supporting terrorism, being a terrorist, or simply having a connection to a terrorist could be enough to throw someone away and ruin their lives. And you might think, well, what could possibly be an example of that? Well, think about it. Suppose you were born in Iran and a family member of yours turns out to be a terrorist. You're not, but you're a family member. And maybe they exploited your relationship in some way to get you into the country or to do something. You had no intention of causing terror or hurting anybody, and yet you now have this connection. And unless you get a fair trial, there's no way to clear your name. So if the government comes along and says, sorry, we're taking away your citizenship and deporting you back to your country, where you face execution, despite the fact that you may be an innocent person, well, that's not good. That's a violation of everything that this country should stand for. One of the things that's come up that I think is quite telling is that it's almost like this is reverting to the medieval form of punishment of exile. You know, if you've committed a crime, regardless of what that crime is, you are entitled to due process. And if you're guilty, you will be punished. I mean, that is the nature of crime and punishment. But you should be judged by the law of this country. And it should not be, the punishment should not be to remove you from the legal system of this country and place you in one where you are at greater jeopardy. If we do not lack, if we lack the political or legal framework, then we should create it democratically and not through these sort of broad sweeping legislations that violate traditional and existing Canadian law. Now, once again, this is a law that has already gone into effect. It can't be taken away except by a new Canadian government, which we all hope it does. But you can still make your voice heard on this. I will post a link to the BC Civil Liberties Association's webpage where you can sign their petition and hopefully motivate government officials and politicians to start putting on pressure to make this go away. Remember, this is not simply about catching terrorists. This could be about catching anyone and creating a second-class style of citizenship. If you are accused of being a terrorist in another country, like a journalist perhaps would be, you can have your citizenship struck here in Canada. It is absolutely egregious and it has to stop. So I do encourage you to sign that petition. It'll be posted in our show notes, available at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, let's take a quick break here on the show. We will return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, we are back here on The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow. And as always, we are broadcasting on CITR. Well, so we just finished talking a bit about some political, social justice-related concerns, Bill C-51, as well as BC-24. I wanted to quickly touch base on a topic that has been trending in the last couple of days, and this involves the website Reddit. Now, you may be familiar with Reddit. It is basically like a big internet forum where people can go and find like-minded people to talk about just about anything. There are subreddits, which are basically forums on Reddit for discussing everything from gaming to interior decoration to relationship advice to, oh, you know, movies, TV, shoes, music, whatever. And Reddit has been existing for a little while. Now it's a very popular website. It is very important for, you know, a kind of a combination of social networking and discussion, sort of bringing certain topics to the forefront of the internet and communication. You know, the big thing is, of course, Ask Me Anything's on Reddit, where famous people will go on there and they'll, you know, engage with people on various topics, important news stories, petitions, issues related to social justice, internet security, the freedom of the internet will be discussed there on Reddit. So it's quite an important website. However, Reddit has a bit of a dark side, and that is there are many subreddits which are dedicated to what we would consider hate speech. Discussions of a very violent nature regarding everything from race, sexuality, body image, religion, society, you name it. There's a Reddit subreddit for talking about how much you hate it. There's also some borderline, you know, criminal, I guess you would consider, subreddits that focus on things like posting pictures of underage girls, talking about criminal offenses, crimes, you know, rape, harassment, whatnot. So there are some pretty dark aspects of the Reddit corners of the internet. And this has led to sort of an interesting juxtaposition where you have, on the one hand, there is a lot of, you know, good, honest people who use Reddit for, you know, good, honest purposes. And then you have this kind of shady, dark side of Reddit, which is, you know, perhaps misused and at times home to some very troubling and disturbing elements of society. Recently, Reddit decided to institute a sort of anti-harassment policy, and they banned a number of small subreddits, many of which were focused on harassment and hate. So, for instance, there was one, the most popular being Fat People Hate, which, you know, sounds as horrible as it is. There were a few others, but I don't really want to say the words on air because they're quite offensive. But you can probably use your imagination. Anyway, after these Reddits were banned, people who frequented those subreddits took to Reddit in general with their anger and frustration and hatred. Basically, the main conversations on Reddit's front page, all over the website, turned to these sort of screaming, angry people about censorship, about repressing of their sort of libertarian bastion here on the internet. And it's led to some interesting conversations because, on the one hand, Reddit has notoriously not censored almost anything on their website. They've allowed some pretty shocking material to be posted. Now, the fact that they've gone ahead and banned a few small subreddits is weird in the sense that they've picked a small handful and ignored some really troubling aspects. If their effort, of course, is then to make Reddit safer and more comfortable for people to use, they've done a little bit of that, but they've left a lot of really horrible things untouched. And you might say, well, what qualifies as horrible? Well, again, you know, some of these Reddits, again, I can't even say the names of them on air because they're so offensive. Some of them focus on things like sexualizing young children. Some of them focus on things like rape and rape apology. Some of them focused on things, men's rights, for instance, which is considered by many to be a hate organization. There are plenty of horribly racist subreddits that say horribly racist things, as you can imagine. And there are also some really kind of disturbing ones that seem to promote things like violence or sexual violence or other forms of harassment slash violent imagery and violent discussion. Now, whether or not those things would qualify as bannable or not, it does raise the question that if you're trying to make Reddit more comfortable and safer, why are you leaving those things behind? I mean, let's not forget that Reddit was also sort of the key tool for sharing all of those photos of celebrities who had their personal accounts hacked and nude pictures posted online. Reddit did very little about that until, you know, far later on in the process, you know, once lawyers got involved. So, I mean, the question is, if Reddit is going to do anything, then can they do so with sort of a half measure? Must they do something a bit more concrete and actually say, if we're going to have a website here that respects the idea of, you know, safety and respect for everyone around us, then we're going to have to do more than just ban a few tiny subreddits. We're going to have to seriously clean up the website. Now, of course, this has led to a lot of very angry, pissed off Redditors who I would just kind of assume mostly are, you know, between the ages of 13 and 19. And predictably, they have raised the issue of this little bit of censorship obviously turns Reddit into a Nazi social justice warrior crazy pot. And of course, you know, I mean, you kind of look at what are the other sort of typical talking points for such people, and it tends to revolve around discussing how female game journalists are ruining the world and how they should be allowed to make rape jokes and post nude pictures of celebrities all the time. It's not the most highbrow of conversation, nor is it all that intellectually stimulating. Now, it is important to point out that censorship and censorship law refers only to the government locking you up for saying things that it doesn't approve of. Reddit, as a private corporation, they are a money-making corporation, they are under no obligation to give anybody, anywhere, a platform on their website or elsewhere to say anything they want. Reddit is totally within their rights to ban anything. They could ban talking about TV shows if they wanted to. That is their right. Any organization, any business has that ability. That is not controversial. That is how society works. So the idea that this is impinging on free speech is actually wrong. It's not. You have the right to say and to think whatever you want, but Reddit is under no obligation to give you a platform to expose those views. And this, I think, brings us to the next big point about this whole story, is that if Reddit wanted to create an anti-harassment policy, or indeed change its image and its posting rules to make Reddit a safer place, then this has clearly failed. But it seems like this was never Reddit's point of view in the first place, as some people have suggested that the only reason Reddit did these things is because people who were posting to the subreddits that got banned had a history of going sort of beyond those small subreddits and harassing other people, sending them personal messages, doxing them and whatnot. So if that was Reddit's goal, was just to get rid of those people, that really doesn't constitute any kind of anti-harassment policy whatsoever. I mean, that's not even really the bare minimum. That's more about protecting their profitability, really. It's about making sure that they're not losing any money based on these people who are giving Reddit a bad name. The reality then, of course, is that unless these other subreddits start costing Reddit money or profitability, they're probably going to keep them around. And in fact, it's been suggested that, in fact, they probably do make Reddit a lot of money, and so they're not going to institute any kind of long-term or comprehensive anti-harassment policy. You know, one of the things, too, that I was looking at, when that leak with regards to the nude images of celebrities spread around Reddit, they made a lot of money off of the web traffic resulting from that. So financially, from a point of view of profit, they are not inclined to try to limit that kind of exposure, because that kind of content, free of any sort of rules, makes them a lot of profit. So really, I mean, I think that a lot of the people who are flying off the handle and comparing Reddit to, you know, a Nazi social justice network really don't have much to worry about, because I don't think Reddit is at all going in that direction in any case. I think likely Reddit is going in a far more shrewd direction of allowing whatever it wants, whatever anybody was willing to post, as long as it doesn't start costing them money. As soon as it does, they'll crack down on it. So, you know, that's an interesting way of looking at this whole situation. The irony, of course, being that the whole point about Reddit is that it's basically totally easy for anybody to go on there and create their own subreddit. I mean, that's part of the appeal of the website. That's sort of why it exists. In order to police that, to institute any kind of top-down reform, ultimately changes the nature of the website. So any kind of major change, shift, or implementation of new rules will dramatically change the way that Reddit operates, and therefore it won't be the same kind of website it's supposed to be. It would ultimately break its own system. And I think, you know, breaking their own system is probably one of the sort of, is one of the, you know, profit negative solutions that they're willing to consider. So ultimately, again, we go back to this question of Reddit is what Reddit is for a very good reason. And that is because they've shown that if you create a website that allows for, you know, very easy trolling and harassment and, you know, the buildup of a community that revolves around hate, if you make that super easy, people are going to use it. And whether or not people use it exclusively for that purpose or, you know, to talk about video games or whatever, regardless, if you change that format, if you change the way that Reddit operates, you stop making it as popular and, again, counterproductive to making profit. So there really is no monetary incentive for Reddit to ever try to do any kind of moderation. And again, by the nature of what it is, any type of moderation would intrinsically change the way the website works. And that's something that, you know, they're just not willing to do because it would cost them too much profit. Well, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector, and we will return after this.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism, as always, broadcasting on CITR. Well, we're running out of time here on today's show, and I did want to get into the truth and reconciliation discussion and also kind of go into a bit of the background of the residential schools program. But I'm thinking that we need to leave that for another day, as that's a pretty big conversation. And I would like to do, you know, proper diligence on that and actually get a really a good chance to, you know, dive deep into the conversation and ultimately say something with a substantial substance and not so much as just kind of give a survey of the history. So what we're going to do is leave that for another day, maybe next week or the week after. I'm not entirely sure just yet. If you have any thoughts on that or any advice, or you just want me to focus on a particular aspect, feel free to let me know. And again, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at Ethan Clow, or visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Now then, there were a few other stories that I did want to touch base on. A few of these are a bit old, but one of them that caught my eye, and this has been kind of making the news rounds for the last few weeks, world hunger falling to a 25-year low on the ascent of China, Brazil, and other nations. So you may have heard of this. According to reports, fewer people are undernourished than any time in the past 25 years, as the rise of developing countries such as China, Brazil, and others have ushered in economic prosperity and improved food production. So according to these stats from both the United Nations and other world hunger agencies, there are 795 million hungry people in the world. That is down from 821 million from 2010 to 2012. Now, according to a report released by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, that means that around 1 in 9 people are still underfed. Now, what's relevant about this, of course, is that this is an improvement. And it may not like seem like one, because that's still a whole lot of people who are suffering. And let's face it, that is awful still. But it does demonstrate an improvement through the kind of developing economic prosperity that we're seeing in countries like China, Brazil, and elsewhere around the world, Southeast Asia in particular. With this improvement, more people are getting food, more people are getting nutrition, they're living longer, healthier lives, and this is leading to a small bit of good news in the fight against world hunger. According to the report, hungry people account for around 10.9% of the global population. The report showed that down from 11.8% in 2011 to 12 and 18.6% in 1990 to 1992. So a major improvement from the 90s. China, Brazil, Vietnam, Thailand are among the 29 countries that have reduced the number of underfed citizens by at least half since 1996. A few exceptions include places like India, where the poor and hungry haven't benefited as much as other nations from the faster economic growth. Of course, national disasters, civic strife have hurt the progress. 24 African countries currently face food crisis, crises, and twice as many as in 1990, the organization said. Hunger is greatest in Eastern and Central Africa, where more than 30% of the population classified as undernourished. Of course, some of the biggest advancements and developments in the lines of preventing world hunger have come from genetically modified food, things like golden rice, for instance. Which is all the more troubling is the fact that there has been quite a big anti-science backlash against things like GMO foods, which, you know, I mean, it really, if you're interested in reducing hunger, if you're interested in making nutrition easier and cheaper and more abundant, you really have to look into the science behind GMO foods to make sure that you understand what exactly is happening there. You know, the idea that you can, in a cheaper fashion, produce food at greater quantities that contain a greater amount of nutritious elements. So not only is the quantity of food you're producing going up, but the quality of that food is also going up, meaning that you're feeding more people, but you're also feeding them better quality food. That is a major, you know, step forward in preventing world hunger. Additionally, if you're able to provide them with food, growing food, plant life, vegetation, whatnot, that can grow under harsher conditions, again, you're not only are you improving the quality, the quantity of food they're getting, but you're improving the quality in terms of its hardiness, its ability to grow in extreme conditions. You know, examples of this are food, corn, rice, etc., that can grow on less water. So in places that are experiencing drought, that's a major advantage, especially in, as I said, disaster relief areas, where you often experience the aftershocks of the disaster, droughts, landslides, other sort of events happening. One of the first things that usually suffers is the ability to grow and sustain food in that area. If you have something that is more hardy, that can grow under more disparate conditions, that will ultimately have a much bigger impact on sustaining food growth. Of course, that's not to say that the only thing that matters in the fight against hunger is GMO foods. Certainly, there are other ways that we can have an impact. And indeed, we shouldn't necessarily take this news as a pat on the back and say, well done, and, you know, hang up our work gloves. So much more to be done. And ultimately, you know, the emphasis is going to have to come on the developed nations as well. You can't just rely on places like Brazil and China to develop and grow their output. You also have to look at ways that some of the developed nations can provide for the world hunger as well. Everything from giving more, you know, from a sort of charitable standpoint, but also through world economic development, which is one of the things that Canada used to be very adept at, but unfortunately in the last 10 years, our international development aspect of our diplomatic outreach has really crumbled. In fact, that's something that we spoke a little bit about with Gareth Kirkby when we had him on the show a few weeks or a few months ago. Again, I wanted to share that news with you, just let you know about that interesting story that's been going around. Again, definitely a good sign, but lots more work to be done. And that just about brings us to the end of this week's show. So once again, I thank you all for tuning in and enjoying episode 47 of The Sector. This is, I guess we're on our sort of countdown for last episodes originating from CITR's old studio. So that will, I guess our last episode will be Friday the 26th, because we are on a Friday morning and the final broadcast is happening in the evening and then the transition to the new studio on the 27th. So then our first new show will be on the 3rd of July, which will be exciting. So we're looking forward to that. So yeah, this is pretty exciting. So episode 47 here on the 12th, followed by 48 on the 19th and 49 on the 26th. So that's kind of, I guess, a bit cool that our 50th episode of The Sector will also be the first episode of The Sector to be broadcast from the new studio. Well, that'll be very exciting. I'm looking forward to that. We'll have to do something kind of special for episode 50. I wonder what it'll be. If you have any ideas, let us know here on the show. Well, we are running out of time on today's episode. So once again, I do want to thank you all for tuning in and listening to The Sector here on CITR. If you want to download the podcast or see our show notes, visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com and you can subscribe there to our show. And I hope to see you next week on the show, and then the week after that, and then finally the week after that in our brand new studio. So this is Ethan Clow saying thank you once again for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and we will see you all next time here on The Sector. Goodbye, everybody. I feel your love. I feel your strong love. I feel the patience of unconditional love. I feel the strength. I feel your faith in. Walk with you. I'm on this journey. I don't